I welcome you to this session of Sunstone. This is the session number 231, Why We Stay. This is about the 10th year or 9th year, I think, we've done this, where we've invited five members of the LDS Church, as well as kind of affiliated group. We had Bill Russell from the Community of Christ, and we had one person who's still considered herself a member of the church, but the church doesn't consider her a member. But we've had, but she still stays. But it's an opportunity for us to hear from people who have given a lot of time and effort and of their lives to the church, and had, I think, on occasion reasons why they might think of not staying with the church, but they've stayed with it. I spoke on the first one, and that's sort of how I felt. And anyway, we've had an opportunity of hearing some wonderful life experiences from these people, and they've spoken, and this year's no exception. We'll start off with our first speaker, Vicki Stewart Eastman. There's really a Muir in there somewhere in there, but Vicki Muir is
his age.
I almost went to work for her father once a long time ago, when she would have been a young girl here in Salt Lake before they moved to California. But she grew up in Northern, spent most of her growing up years in Northern California.
No, actually here in Salt Lake.
Did you?
Northern California came later.
Came later, okay. So you didn't go to California with it.
Yeah, well, it's complicated.
Okay, anyway, she's been a speaker here on, I think of her merit, always representing the feminist point of view very well at Sunstone, in talking about temple endowment ceremony, or participation in the church, and things like that. Okay, our second speaker is Bill Hansen, who's an attorney practicing in Payson, Utah. We've been talking about here about the merits of spending time in Payson, and he assures me that it's not the backwater place that I probably thought it was. It has a lot more to offer than that. Third is Kathleen Catani, who is a longtime friend of my family, my children, and me, and she has lived in the Bay Area for many years. Now she's been a practicing attorney down there. She was president of the primary in a marriage stake when she was a single individual, and she struggled with some of that. And she's recently married and has inherited a family of two, and now has three in the family, and I think doing a great job of both continuing to work as well as being a good, great mother. Fourth is Dan Witherspoon, who was the managing editor of Sunstone for about 8 years when I was chairman of the board at Sunstone, and still involved with the board of trustees. But it's Dan, I think, in my mind, distinguished himself as someone who chose to go to the Claremont Divinity School or school, whatever theological school was it, and chose to take a set of, to do his dissertation on Mormon studies and Mormonism, and emerged from there at a time when that carried zero currency in the job market. He couldn't get a job. Came back to Salt Lake here and sort of taught ad hoc a little bit, worked at the bookstore, and finally, fortunately, was there and available to us when we were looking for an editor of Sunstone. And Dan did a marvelous job, and he just changed off about a year ago now, and is still a member of the board. And our final speaker is Emma Lou Warner Thane. She wanted me to emphasize that there's Warner in her name. Her dear brother, Rick, was someone that was very dear to me. He lived in my ward and was a great tennis player, as was Emma Lou. Anyway, she has been involved in Mormon issues for generations, decades and decades and decades. She has a hymn in the hymn book, which is, a real distinguishing accomplishment. She also sat toe-to-toe with the brethren in being on the board of both on the MIA Young Women's General Board, as well as for 17 years as sole member of the Deseret News Board. And when there was talk that, you know, the women might get the priesthood someday, why, Emma Lou was immediately my candidate to become the first member of the Quorum of the Twelve. Anyway, we'll proceed in that order. They know their time limits are 15 minutes, so they don't get stuck on each other's time. And if they don't live with that, I'll have to remind them. But anyway, so we'll start with Vicki.
Can you all hear me all right? Great. Well, hello and welcome to you all. Let's just hope the lights stay on and they stay on bright enough for me to read this. Since we're into names, my full name is Vicki Muir Stewart Eastman, just so you know. To begin, let me tell you about my background. I was born Vicki Muir in Salt Lake City, Utah in 1948. And raised the oldest of six children in a Mormon family that was always active, but never temple active. I always felt that I was something of a Mormon princess due to the fact that my maternal grandmother, Laverne Watts Parmley, was the general president of the primary all during my growing up years, the last woman to have true control of that organization before correlation removed all significant organizational power from women in the 1970s. I married in the Salt Lake Temple at the age of 20 and raised four children in the church in California, Northern California, serving mostly in primary callings. Because of my support for the ERA and women's issues in general, I was never regarded as a safe enough bet for the young women and have never served in that organization and only occasionally in a relief society. In 1992, I left my marriage and California to move back to Utah with my four teenage children, settling in Holiday, where I live today. Almost immediately, I ran into trouble with the institutional church here over the excommunication of scholars, most of whom I knew, in September of 1993. I was especially angry because Paul Toscano, one of those targeted, was in my ward, and it was my state president who prosecuted him, despite attempts by my bishop to find a peaceful solution. When I felt completely torn up inside over the deceit and harshness I witnessed, a friend suggested to me a way to cope. To this day, at his suggestion, I take the sacrament twice every Sunday, once for those who have been cut off and driven out, and once for me. In the midst of all this turmoil, I came into conflict with my daughter's ninth grade seminary teacher, a brother Davis, who was so persistently homophobic and chauvinistic with his young students that I largely blame him for my daughter's abandonment of Mormonism. That man will have to account for some young souls before the judgment seat, believe me. In addition, I found myself at the center of various controversies when I taught Relief Society and four memorable years of gospel doctrine. Nevertheless, two of my sons serve missions, although only one of my children is really active today. In spite of all of this, I am currently active in my ward and serve as the ward music chair. I was just released as the visiting teaching coordinator, thank goodness. I've had a lot of reasons to go, so why do I stay? In my particular case, it can be said I stay because I have found a comfortable place in an uncomfortable organization. It turns out that I like my ward and the people in it. We have been blessed with a string of moderate, non-authoritarian bishops who treat ward members with kindness and respect and avoid pushing them unduly on religious matters. Like me, many in my ward have suffered setbacks and disappointments in their lives, and we have trusted one another with an honest accounting of our trials. Those in my ward are good people, trying to walk the good walk, and who wouldn't want to spend time every week with good people? I honestly feel the Holy Ghost hovering over us all, everyone, in sacrament meeting most Sundays. Because there is a politically liberal core of people in the group, I felt just fine driving to church with my Obama sticker every week during the last election. Although I can name some for whom that was probably an irritation, including the couple my husband and I home teach who are active in the Minutemen organization. Now, I'm not crazy about their bumper stickers either. But I like the two of them and try to be of service to them. I enjoy the high level of teaching in my ward, especially in gospel doctrine, where one teacher, an institute instructor, often leads discussions on current events, rushing in where angels would fear to tread. Certainly a woman would fear to tread. I doubt there are many Sunday school classes that have achieved a balanced discussion of California's Proposition 8, but my ward did. I really enjoy hearing the ward members' stories and following their lives. Religion, in my opinion, is best lived in community, and my ward serves that function well. Because of discussions at Sunstone pointing out that women have the greatest organizational influence at the ward level, I have consciously avoided state callings and remain resolutely in my little congregation. I realize with sadness that none of this is of any help to those of you who are in intolerant, authority-based Mormon wards. If I were in one of those, I probably would be inactive. Another big reason I participate is my calling as ward music chair. Miraculously, my ward is blessed with an unusual core of fine musicians, including an excellent choir director and two organists, one of them my husband, Alan, both of whom compose and arrange original music for our services. Really, the music alone is worth going every Sunday. And by scheduling it week to week and planning major programs, I am directly affecting the spirituality that people enjoy in our worship. Now, I am no real musician myself, but I am a good organizer, and consider it my mission in the world to see to it that our congregation has a memorable musical and spoken program for Christmas, and especially for Easter. To be honest, one of my favorite aspects of this calling is that it gives me a good deal of control over the major Christian holidays. Control which my bishops have either encouraged or at least have never contested. For years, I have been incensed at the casual treatment of Easter by the LDS Church, in which this central Christian celebration routinely is overlooked and forgotten in the wake of General Conference and the attendant floating fast Sunday. One little memo from church headquarters would rectify the situation by proclaiming a church-wide, non-fast Sunday, ward-level Easter remembrance, at least on those years when Easter doesn't fall on General Conference. Sadly, we have waited for years without any guidance from above, leading me to wonder just what it means to be a special witness for Christ in a church that would allow mindless organizational calendaring to trump Easter year after year. My calling allows me to rectify this problem, at least in one ward. I also have a calling that I have given myself. I have put myself in charge of flower arrangements for the two corners of the stand because I hate bare chapels. I purchase two basic flowers, vases of white silk flowers that I augment monthly with a changing variety of additional silk flowers according to the season. The entire high priest closet, with the exception of one shelf, is now full of flowers. They are such good guys to help me out. There are yet other reasons I participate besides the good luck of landing in a good ward. I echo one quotation we heard from Mary Farrell Bednarowski on Wednesday evening. I have been richly nurtured by a tradition that constrains me. I have been richly nurtured by a tradition that constrains me. That paradoxical statement absolutely defines my experience. The church has shaped me profoundly, being as it has been the stage upon which I have acted out my life. Church activity has succeeded in leading me to develop a surprisingly deep foundation of spirituality, which has informed everything in my thinking. Because of my participation, I have avoided the health difficulties of smoking and drinking. I have received answers to important personal questions while in the temple. My church life has given me many opportunities to develop myself, while the members and leaders have been mostly patient in allowing me to sing my idiosyncratic, personal little song. I have been provided with lifelong friends. I have enjoyed attending Sunstone for years and years now. No doubt about it, I find it very interesting to be part of the Mormon religion. I have often felt that we are shaped as much by what we oppose as by what we embrace. The LDS Church has served as the whetstone upon which I have sharpened many an intellectual and ethical blade. A key player in most of the battles in which I have been engaged, and the impetus for my biggest thoughts and bravest moments, often in opposition to its policies. Because I was born into the heart of Mormonism and have contributed so much of my time, energy, and money to its programs, I feel I have paid my dues and am justified in speaking my mind when things go awry. I usually can be counted on to bring out the responsible opposing viewpoint during Relief Society lessons, articulating, I hope, the thoughts of many women who have a hard time speaking up. For instance, on a recent Sunday, when we had a lesson that was especially emphatic on obedience to church leaders, I raised my hand to say that those of us who have lived long enough in the church have sometimes seen misguided policies strongly pushed for a period and then quietly dropped in more enlightened times, leading us to conclude that not all policies are wise or binding. I gave two examples. Number one, birth control was strongly discouraged in the 1970s, to the point of some members' temple recommends hanging on whether or not they admitted to using it. As a result of this ecclesiastical micromanagement, many people of my generation had more children than they wanted or could easily raise. The general authorities who articulated the policy didn't have to support all those children, but those who bore them out of obedience did. There is a sense of resentment from some of those parents now that the current church manual of instructions, which is off limits to general church members, states that the number and timing of children is between the couple and God. Church officials have never publicly reversed the prior policy or apologized to those it overburdened, a typical method of moving forward, oblivious to the hurt that has been caused, and hoping members will just forget it ever happened. Levina Fielding Anderson calls this institutional forgetting. Number two, when I was a teenager in the 1960s, the idea that a girl would be better off dead than sexually impure, even due to rape, was very current in the church. The implication of this teaching hit me full force when I was the victim of an attempted rape in 1970. As the rapist's knife was cutting off my clothes, although he was mightily puzzled by those old one-piece garments, I had to make the decision whether to resist and end up in a pool of blood on a carport floor or do what I could to survive the experience and go on to recover and live the precious life I had been given. I chose to live. I was lucky enough to escape the rape in the end, although not the terror of the attack. Nowadays, a teaching this harsh would be out of place, but it had consequences in its day. I summed up my remarks in that Relief Society lesson by saying that we need to use common sense in our lives and try to forgive our leaders when they need to be more educated. The Relief Society president later wrote me an email thanking me for my words. Of course, like many of you, I have my bad days at church. One such occurred just last Sunday in a Relief Society lesson about the founding of the Relief Society. The teacher was a younger woman who obviously knew little of the facts, or she would not have used Joseph Smith's words chastising women for gossiping with a straight face. Those who have read Linda King Newell's book Mormon Enigma know that Joseph Smith used those words to try to shut down rumors of his polygamous relationships, which were true. After all these years, Mormon women are still accused of being gossips, when what was really going forth was a cover-up. Keeper of unwelcome history that I am, however, there are times in church discussions when I just sit in silence, as I did in this case, or exchange meaningful glances with friends who are thinking the same thoughts that I am. Despite the general degree of comfort in my ward, I recently had an internal crisis of faith that left me wondering if I should, after all, stay. I recently took a trip to London and went with my husband to the British Museum. We were entranced by the Egyptian mummies and tomb paintings, the Assyrian lion hunts carved in stone, and the statues of the Greek Parthenon. As I looked at those artifacts of ancient and accomplished civilizations, it struck me forcefully how little they had to do with Mormonism. Whole groups of people have lived and died completely outside of any Mormon context, and yet have produced art and culture that are world treasures today. Sometimes it seems to me that in our church, everything has to be about us, 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 and the whole world has to be squeezed down into a little correlated wall in order to validate our views. I'm finding more and more that I'm no longer interested in the unique truth claims of Mormonism. Instead, I'm interested in broader spiritual questions that affect all humankind. This realization seriously troubled me for a period of several weeks. Its implications grieved me. Lacking any real interest in Mormonism's claims to be the one true church, I probably will never again be called to teach or be in a leadership role. Now, that's a hard pill to swallow for a prima donna like myself. Given my lack of commitment to organizational goals and concerns, some would say that I shouldn't even be going to church, that I'm not sufficiently in tune to attend. Some might even say that I don't deserve to attend. I took the matter to God during the sacrament one Sunday, a habit I have cultivated when I am in distress. For much of my life, I've asked for guidance at critical junctions and have truly received inspiration on what to do, often by means of short sentences that come into my mind immediately after prayer. In this case, I explained my difficulties to God, saying that perhaps I was a bad Mormon and should just leave. Instead, I got a surprising answer. Let me explain. For years, I found the concept of stages of spiritual growth based on the work of James Fowler to be helpful in understanding how I fit into Mormonism. Discussions of these stages usually say that as we get older and we move from one stage to the next, we tend to lose our dependence on organized religion for our sense of spirituality, and our view opens up until we see an underlying connectedness between ourselves and the community of all other living things. We become concerned about spirituality on a bigger and more inclusive scale. These are the stirrings I have felt within myself. But to return to my prayer during the sacrament, my answer was a nonverbal reminder of the stages of spiritual growth, followed by this sentence: "You are not a bad Mormon. You are just walking through a new door." What a relief. I interpreted that message to mean that my frustration with the narrowness of institutional Mormonism is an outgrowth of my moving along a positive spiritual path, leading me to something broader and more fruitful, rather than an indication of my personal failings. Now, if that expanded view will only enable me to become more patient, more kind, and more forgiving, goals that continue to elude me, I feel I will be truly walking through a new door rather than just being stuck at the threshold. The same friend who suggested taking the sacrament twice for those who have been excommunicated articulated a wonderful statement that best describes my place in the LDS Church. I am a Christian in the Mormon tradition. Let me repeat that. I am a Christian in the Mormon tradition. This statement puts matters in the right order, honoring both my roots in the LDS Church and my branches that stretch up towards the sky, sometimes out of sight of Mormonism. In closing, I would say that I stay because mainstream Mormonism is my stage to act upon, an opposition to develop myself around, my tribe, my spiritual home, my community. It may be a dysfunctional home at times, but it is my home. I have earned the right to be there and to comment and contribute. I am reminded of one of my favorite poems entitled "Church Going" by poet Philip Larkin, which is about a man who stops to visit a rural parish church in England. This poem ran through my head over and over again during my recent trip to England and Scotland, where I visited churches and the ruins of churches and their attendant churchyards full of headstones and monuments. Let me read you the end of the poem. "Yet stop I did. In fact, I often do and always end up much of a loss like this. Yet tending to this cross of ground, because it held unspilt so long and equably what sense is found only in separation, marriage and birth and death and thoughts of these. For though I've no idea what this accoutred frousty barn is worth, it pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized and robed as destinies, and that much never can be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground, which, he once heard, was proper to grow wise in. if only that so many dead lie around. I stay because most Sundays I find myself in a serious house on serious earth, where my most important compulsions meet and are robed as destinies. Since I am forever surprising in myself a hunger to be more serious, I find I gravitate with it to this ground, my ward, the small rich world which for me has become the church. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vicki. I delight in her image of the Holy Ghost hovering, her statements that we need each other, that we have been richly nurtured by an organization that constrains us. The mundane experiences of religion can sometimes feel more like a closed door than an open window to connections with God. I have been taught by inspired people and by my own experience seeking God. I was taught that a heart open to mysticism is spiritual. I was taught that mystical moments, peak experiences, if you will, can drive a soul forever. I was taught that religion is the vehicle of preserving the best of spirituality. I was taught that belief is what we cling to when threatened, and that faith is courageous trust. I was taught that gratefulness can lead to mystical experiences and is the heart of prayer. I was taught that love means saying yes to belonging, and that loving your neighbor as yourself means loving your neighbor as being yourself. I was taught that morality is how a person behaves toward people with whom he or she belongs together. I was taught that when intellect swoops down on a peak experience, questions are born which result in creativity, which leads to teaching, which leads to religion. I was taught that religion can translate a mystical heart into daily living. I wish to share with you today that God has done that for me through my participation in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I was taught that obedience comes from the Latin ob audience, which means to listen, and that creativity is as important as strictly adhering to ritualized performance. I was taught that the essence of godliness is manifest in ordinances, but that rigid adherence to orthodox rituals without the mystical lacks the ability to exalt the soul. I was taught that word is spirit, which means to me that words are the vehicle of spiritual creation, that words and music are gateways to mystical peaks. I was taught that my choices count now and before this earth life, and that I am responsible, accountable, a keeper, a seeker, and a finder. While I did not learn all of these lessons through church meetings, I find fertile ground to experience these principles as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. These teachings and my participation in the church have converged to enlarge the mystical aspects of my soul and propel me to be and to do more. I have discovered that such experiences are available to everyone and can be recognized even by the very young and inexperienced. God desires all to receive it. There's a beautiful summary of our mortal adventure in Robert Frost's poem, Trial by Existence. I'd like to try to share that with you. Even the bravest that are slain shall not dissemble their surprise on waking to find valor reign, even as on earth in paradise. And where they sought without the sword, wide fields of asphodel for air, to find that the utmost reward of daring should be still to dare. The light of heaven falls whole and white, and is not shattered into dyes. The light forever is morning light. The hills are verdure, pasture-wise. The angel hosts with freshness go, and seek with laughter what to brave, and binding all is the hushed snow of the far distant breaking wave. And from a cliff top is proclaimed the gathering of the souls for birth, the trial by existence named, the obscuration upon earth. And the slant spirits trooping by in streams and cross and counter streams can but give ear to that sweet cry for a suggestion of what seems. And the more loitering are turned to view once more the sacrifice of those who for some good discerned will gladly give up paradise. And a white shimmering concourse rolls toward the throne to witness there this feeding of devoted souls which God makes his especial care. And none are taken, but who will, having first heard the life read out, that opens earthward good and ill beyond the shadow of a doubt. And very beautifully God limns and tenderly life's little dream, but not extenuates or dims, setting the thing that is supreme. Nor is there wanting in the press some spirit to stand simply forth, heroic in its nakedness against the uttermost of earth. The tale of life's unhonored things sounds nobler there than neath the sun, and the mind whirls and the heart sings, and a shout greets the daring one. But always God speaks at the end, one word in agony of strife. The bravest would have by for friend the memory that he chose the life. But the pure fate to which you go admits no memory of the choice. Else the woe were not earthly woe to which you give the assenting voice. And so the choice must be again, but the last choice is still the same. And the awe passes wonder then, and a hush falls for all acclaim. And God has taken a flower of gold and broken it and used therefrom the mystic link to bind and hold spirit to matter till death come. 'Tis of the essence of life here, though we choose greatly still to lack the lasting memory at all clear, that life has for us on the rack nothing but what we somehow chose. Thus are we wholly stripped of pride in the pain that has but one close, bearing it crushed and mystified. I will focus for a moment on the importance of words. The Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 1, tells us, "In the beginning was the Word," and that one of Jesus Christ's names is the Word. In John 6, we're told that after Christ fed the 5,000, he proclaimed himself the bread of life, and commanded that all should eat his flesh and drink his blood in order to gain eternal life. He proclaimed that the words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. Many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. The apostles stayed, and Jesus asked them, "We also go away?" And Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life, and we believe and are sure that thou art that Christ, the Son of the living God." Thus we too discover that our daily bread from God is laced with mysticism. Some words that have accompanied my personal mystical experiences include the nature of the Godhood, priesthood, knowledge, love, marriage, gender, other lives, and charity. Speaking of words and their importance reminds me of the Catholic scholar who emerged from the Vatican Library and announced, "Brethren, we were wrong. The word was celebrate." As I have applied the principles of religion to these words, I recognize that my understanding and faith have progressed through a series of levels, kind of like Vicky was saying. I'm sure that my initial faith was very self-serving and fear-based. I remember a phase that focused on structured faith based on literal interpretation and lots of rules. I can remember moving into a self-governing, personally motivated period, and finally I can remember being aware of the expansiveness of ideas, the ability to hold a dilemma. My experience is that the church accommodates souls at all of these levels, and that interaction at these levels contributes to everyone's development. If those who find it easier and more meaningful to connect with God at a higher level leave the church, the process of spiritual development is disrupted at all levels, and there will be fewer mentors to draw people to a mature mysticism. We truly need each other. An example of one of my personal mystical and religious experiences is as follows. In my profession, I'm often confronted by people whose personal lives are in turmoil as a result of some relationship conundrum. Debbie was one such person. Her husband was a general contractor, an active member of the LDS Church. By active, I mean that he attended his church meetings, held church position as president of the Elders Quorum. As a contractor, he would leave town for days at a time for various jobs. During his days away from home, he would be provided for. He had lodging, he had food. He would, however, leave his family and children without resources. They ended up having to pick dandelion greens for food and forage for apples in people's orchards. Because he held a visible church position, he was very concerned that his wife and family not receive help from the church. One specific example of his neglect involved the fact that he and his wife moved into a small, poorly furnished home in southern Utah County. He and his wife slept on the floor because they had no bed. After several years, his wife begged him for a bed. When none was forthcoming, she told him she was unsure about where she was on his list of priorities, but she wanted to be considered at least as important as one of his customers. So she got a paper route, saved $600, gave the money to her husband, and asked him again to build her a bed because he was so good at building things for other people. He accepted the money from her, but never built the bed. Though they had been married in the temple, she gradually became discouraged and came to see me as an attorney for a divorce. I was reluctant to rush the process and requested that we counsel with church leaders. Her stake president asked her to make a list of the things her husband had not responded to that were important to her. She listed several items. Upon showing the list to her stake president, he commented, "With a list that long, it's obvious you're too demanding and picky. No one could live up to your expectations." Needless to say, she was devastated. I asked her bishop, "Where on a list of priorities does a wife come?" "Well," was the reply, "God is first, then your neighbor as yourself, and since your wife is an extension of yourself, she comes at the bottom of the list where you place yourself." That answer disturbed my thoughts for months. The question of priority was constantly on my mind. Then an October conference in a priesthood session, then president of the church, Ezra Taft Benson, gave a talk about marriage, quoting the 42nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 22, that says, "To love your wife with all your heart." He stated that, to the best of his knowledge, there was only one other time in the scriptures people were commanded to love something with all their hearts, and that was God himself. He followed that talk with another talk given during the spring of 1987 conference when he stated that charity was the first commandment. Those pronouncements immediately resolved my questions of priority. It was as if time stood still, and I had received a direct answer from God. I knew exactly how it would resolve Debbie's dilemma, and what could have worked to save her marriage. Since that time, many marriages have been saved using that information. I came to understand that the spouse had priority and that a person loved God best by loving their spouse first. That event has remained in my mind as fresh as the day it happened. For me, it was a mystical experience, and the catalyst was Ezra Taft Benson acting as president of the church in General Conference. I came to understand the love of God as involving both His waiting patiently for us to become like Him and His reaching out for us as the Good Shepherd. The contrasting parables of the prodigal son and the Good Samaritan are illustrations of each. In the parable of the prodigal son, the father patiently waits for his son's return. An interesting treatment of this parable is found in the book The Welcoming Door by Ken Kemp. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, God reaches out and rescues. I've seen over and over both types of love in the church, both waiting and reaching. I have seen people wrestle with dilemmas. Emma Smith struggled with plural marriage. Some revelations are of God, some are of man, and some are of the devil, she said. And yet she also said that Joseph Smith could neither write nor dictate a coherent, well-worded letter, let alone dictate a book like the Book of Mormon. It's marvelous to me as much to anyone. I'm satisfied that no man could have dictated the writing of the manuscripts unless he was inspired. In closing, I say, because the love of God reaches for us and God waits for us to become like Him. And in spite of the mundane aspects of the church, I realize that the love of God is manifest and that mystical experiences are available in our community. I am convinced that there is mysticism in the church and that personal revelation continues and that spiritual growth is being fostered. Thank you very much.
I've got this bifocal thing going on with the contact in one lens so I can see all of you, and one eye without it so I can read my talk, and I'm hoping that it's going to work. It's not uncommon for a speaker to tell something about themselves before they speak, and to that end, I thought I might offer a little bit of family genealogy. A few years ago, my brother and his wife decided to assemble genealogy workers from relatives around the country. I'm sure you're familiar with genealogy worksheets with their many extending branches showing each family line. One of the branches that was of particular interest was my mother's maternal line. It traces back through my grandmother, Florence Rosella Marsh, my great-grandmother, Florrie Green, born in England in 1884, and Florrie's father, Theophilus Green, born in 1860 in England. From there, the genealogy becomes more difficult. Theophilus Green's mother is listed as Matilda Green, born in 1841. His father is listed as "she wouldn't say." As you might imagine, that particular line ends at that point. In any event, I am the great-great-great-granddaughter of "she wouldn't say." A couple of months ago, when Toby called me and left me a message asking if I would speak here today on the topic of why I stay, my first thought was, who says I'm staying? My second thought was, how could I possibly speak on why I stay when, unlike my great-great-grandmother who wouldn't say, I couldn't say why I stay. I kept asking myself the same question and had yet to answer it. I decided that perhaps Toby's invitation was the opportunity to answer the question for myself. It gave me the impetus to take the time to reflect on my life experience, my spiritual life, my struggles, my doubts and questions, my hopes, my faith, and my life stories. For that, I am grateful. Last November, when Proposition 8 passed in California, defining marriage under the California Constitution as between being a man and a woman, My husband and I were so discouraged, we simply skipped church the Sunday after the election. We did not have the heart to go. The autumn had been difficult. We were in a ward in the Bay Area in California where it felt like we, along with my in-laws who attend the same ward, were the only members who opposed Prop 8. If there were any other members who were against it, they were not speaking out about it. It was a lonely time. When Prop 8 passed, my husband and I asked ourselves, why are we still part of this organization that not only sanctions discrimination within, but took an active role to ensure discrimination outside its own organization? But then I wondered, why was I reacting so strongly to the church's position toward gay marriages when I've lived with the church's position on women in the priesthood all of my life? I'm also personally familiar with the church's seeming reluctance to acknowledge any family unit other than the traditional family unit. I did not get married until I was 40 years old, when I married a man with two children who at the time were 8 and 9 years old. My husband had been born and raised in the church, but was inactive for most of his adult life. He reactivated when he met me, and together we've been raising our three sons in the church. In addition to the two older boys, we have a toddler who's almost 3 years old. After each of our older boys received the Aaronic priesthood, the ward clerk dutifully handed me their individual ordinance summary. Conspicuously absent from their record was my name. I was not listed as their stepmother, nor was I even listed as the current spouse of their father. While I can appreciate that their biological mother, even though she is outspokenly anti-Mormon, should be included on their record, I found it ironic that the woman who was primarily responsible for their activity in the church, not to mention their eating their vegetables, was not included. At least on all the school forms, the camp forms, and medical forms, there is a place for me as an important person in their lives. But I digress. The church's position on gay marriage felt as though it might be the proverbial straw to break the camel's back. My husband and I determined that if it weren't for the fact that we were raising teenagers, we would stop going. Despite the perceived and real discrimination endorsed by the church, we were benefiting from the influence of good people in our lives and the lives of our children. As our teenage sons struggled to come to terms with the fact that their biological mother is an alcoholic, seminary this past year offered a safe haven. We are grateful for the positive influence of the leaders in the young men's program and the interest they take in our sons' lives. We appreciate living in a ward with many couples who are studying at Stanford, and we hope that their influence has a trickle-down effect that reinforces our own emphasis on the importance of education. So that is the simple answer as to why we stay. We do not want to raise teenagers on our own, and we have neither the time nor the energy to seek out another church that will help us raise our children. But in reality, it is not so simple. To really understand why I stay, I have to look to the past as well as the present and the future. And I realize the reasons I give today may be different in the future, as convictions and understanding often change based on experience, perspective, and time. In any event, I offer you the following reflections on why I'm still here. I come from a family with a strong and abiding faith in the LDS Church. Two of my great-grandparents converted to the Mormon Church in Europe and came to America to practice their new faith. Another ancestor crossed the plains. My parents met in the 1950s LDS version of the Young Adult Program in Southern California. My mother was president of the Gleaners and my father was the president of the MMs. After marrying in St. George Temple, they graduated from BYU and raised their five children in the church. All five of us graduated from BYU, and four of us served missions. My father served in a bishopric when I was a child growing up in Arizona, and my mother was a state girls' camp director for 13 years. In conjunction with their faith and activity, my parents also subscribed to Dialogue from its inception in the 1960s and to Sunstone when it appeared on the scene years later. In the 1970s, my mother worked because she wanted to, not because she had to, and she was vocal in her support of the ERA. The loneliness my husband and I felt during the church's campaign in favor of Prop 8 brought to mind what my mother must have felt during the church's campaign against the ERA. I have consciously attended church for most of my life, completed a mission, and served in many callings, including my current calling as a Relief Society teacher. I've worked hard to be a standard Mormon, but in all honesty, I don't feel like one. For most of my adult life, I have felt on the fringe of church life, or to use a Sunstone term, on the borderland. I have found as I've gotten older and faced more challenges and realities in life that I know a lot less now than I used to. Today, I do not have the same clarity of conviction of knowing that something is true as I did when I returned home from a mission 24 years ago. Although I don't think I was ever wired to appreciate the moral clarity of a black and white world, somehow I see greater shades of gray with each passing year. So why do I stay? Several years ago, I was asked to speak in a state conference on the subject of reaffirming a testimony. The member of the state presidency who asked me to speak was someone I had been working with in the state primary and someone I held in high regard. In declining the opportunity, I explained that I struggle a lot with my testimony and couldn't say that I know the church is true. This fine man replied that he understood and told me, "Most of us who are at all self-aware experience a hunger for things spiritual. Our search can be endless and range over the universe of avenues of truth and enlightenment. In the final analysis, however, those of us who have felt the Spirit and have had spiritual confirmation, like ones I believe I heard you describe when you were on your mission, will only find joy and satisfaction when we come home and come to terms with the emotional, spiritual wiring and experiences that we have come to know at earlier stages of life. I stay because my emotional and spiritual wiring stem from my Mormon upbringing. My spiritual awakenings are rooted in the Mormon community. My identity and my worldview are inextricably Mormon. I fundamentally see myself as a child of God. While I may not have the same clear perspective of who God is as I did as a child, I want to believe in a personal, loving God who cares about me. I stay because my parents stayed. Service was important to them, and they modeled how a member could be active and involved, yet thoughtful and accepting of doubts, questions, and disbelief. I remember as a teenager having a discomforting feeling after reading an article about Joseph Smith and one of his controversial practices or teachings. It was probably in Dialogue. Although I don't remember the specific concern, I remember questioning my dad about it and his response. He reassuringly reminded me that Joseph was a man. He got into his pants one leg at a time, just like everyone else. I stay because of the community that I find here. In the book of Acts, it is said of Jesus that he went about doing good. The same can be said for many of the Mormons that I grew up with, as well as many I have met in my adult life. They went about doing good. When I started high school, my family moved from Arizona to a small town in the Central Valley of California. A few years later, my mother was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Complications following surgery left her severely compromised and partially paralyzed. In the months following her surgery, the members of our small ward in that small town showed us a tremendous amount of caring, love, and support. They brought food, routinely visited, and fasted and prayed for us. 9 months later, my father was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor. After radiation treatment and a period of remission, the cancer returned. In the last months of his life, we were fortunate to be able to care for him at home. One day, we had a surprise visit from the two men my father had served with in the bishopric in Arizona more than a dozen years prior. They showed up on our California doorstep unannounced. Sorry. To spend the day with us, reminiscing, sharing stories, and laughter about my father. It is a visit that I will never forget. During the last month of my father's life, the men from his high priest group, took turns staying with him at night so that we could sleep. One of them was with him when he died early in the morning. The members of our ward brought to life the words of Messiah of those who are willing to bear one another's burdens and to mourn with those that mourn and comfort those that stand in need of comfort. I do not doubt that there are other communities of faith that provide the kind of support my family experienced during these difficult times. My Baptist and Catholic friends speak fondly of the communities that they grew up in. Garrison Keillor's stories of the Lutherans who live in Lake Wobegon are not unlike some of my experiences in the Mormon community. That being said, this is my community, and this is where I belong. Another reason I stay is that the church provides an incredible forum for service, personal growth, and self-actualization. When I served as a missionary in Lima, Peru, about midway through my mission, I was assigned to an area in the northern part of Peru that had been devastated by floods the year before. The people were poor, and there were children running barefoot and half-naked around open sewers. I was feeling emotionally drained from trying to help people who did not really want our help, and from seeing so much poverty all the time. I sometimes wondered what kind of a futile endeavor was I engaged in. Was it really worth the struggle? I expressed these feelings to my mission president during an interview, and he acknowledged that it was hard, and quoted Joseph Smith, "A religion that does not require the sacrifice of all things never has power sufficient to produce the faith necessary unto life and salvation." He went on to reassure me that the mission is a sacrifice. It's not always a bed of roses. Everyone feels the struggle. The best we can do is to learn to roll with the punches. So I stay for the same reason that I sometimes want to leave. The church requires sacrifice. However, it is those very sacrifices that have helped me to grow in ways I never could have imagined. It is the sacrifice of my time and various callings that has provided me with some of the closest friendships and relationships that I have. Excuse me. Finally, I stay because Mormonism offers a robust, empowering theology that inspires and challenges me. For example, I like the idea that we existed as intelligences independent of God before we became spiritual offspring of God. I like the idea that we are spiritual offspring of God, that we lived before we came to earth, that we're here to learn and progress, and that we will continue to progress even after our sojourn on earth ends. I'm not that interested in becoming a god or a queen or a priestess, but I love the idea that I can keep learning and progressing in the next life, and that I can continue my relationships with family and friends well beyond this mortal life. Mormonism, with its many doctrines and expectations, often comes across as an all-or-nothing proposition. The lofty ideals and grand expectations can be overwhelming, angst-inducing, identity-erasing, the list goes on. While I love many aspects of our rich theology, I have found that this whole cloth approach does not work for me. There are doctrines and teachings that do not mean too much to me right now, even if they did at some point earlier in my life. In her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, Elizabeth Gilbert talks about flexibility in religion and choosing what works for you. She says, "People are embarrassed to go cherry-picking in religion. This is a sentiment I completely respect, except for the fact I totally disagree." She then goes on to say, "I think you have every right to cherry-pick when it comes to moving your spirit and finding peace in God. I think you are free to search for any metaphor whatsoever which will take you across the worldly divide whenever you need to be transported or comforted. It's nothing to be embarrassed about. It's the history of mankind's search for holiness. You take whatever works from wherever you can find it, and you keep moving toward the light. I find it works for me to cherry pick the doctrines and teachings that resonate for me and set aside the ones that don't. As I think about my life as a Mormon and my own spiritual journey, I recognize that my understanding and interpretations of parables, stories, doctrines, even my own life stories, have changed and will continue to change over time as new experiences change me." Robert Frost once wrote, "For dear me, why abandon a belief merely because it ceases to be true? Cling to it long enough, and not a doubt, it will turn true again, for so it goes." Whether or not I believe everything the church teaches or see things through the same lenses as my fellow ward members, it does not change my appreciation for my connection to this community or my commitment to principles grounded in the teachings of Christ. I'm glad to be part of a community that values love, free agency, faith, forgiveness, grace, redemption, service, and gratitude. I'm grateful to associate with others who strive to be honest and true and who go about it doing good. Thank you.
In the past decade, I've become much more open to feeling my way through life. I love to think of myself as a smart guy, but experience after experience shows me that the only good decisions I make are those that are not initiated by my head, but are the ones that come as I carefully examine my feelings. Why was it that I reacted this way when I met that person?
Oh, they can't hear.
Why was it that I reacted that way when I met this person, when I read that book, or when I had that experience? The older I've gotten, the more I've come to trust the feelings I have, especially the persistent ones, as data points that deserve every bit as much, if not more, consideration as I construct and reconstruct my understanding of things and decide where and how to spend my time and efforts. I bring this up at the beginning of this short reflection on why I stay actively engaged in the church, because the persistent feeling I have that most days I attend church meetings and engage members of my ward and the extended LDS community is one of peace and general contentment. My brain definitely kicks in regularly. Hey, did you notice that? And make sure that I see every short-sighted action, every close-minded comment, every move or statement that seems motivated by fear more than love, by the letter rather than the spirit of the law. But even through all of that, somehow the feeling remains. I'm at peace being here. I want to stay. My earliest temple-going experiences were all about my head. What is going on here? What can this symbol mean? Why do we do this action? And of course, my ego demanded that I learn all my parts perfectly. I've got to impress those temple workers by my faultless memorization and the soulful delivery of my lines. After a while, though, I learned to relax into the endowment, to put my cognitive filters in the background and to simply enjoy being there in the temple with my fellow Latter-day Saints, seeking connection with the wider human family and with life's deepest purposes. The actual words spoken, the actions performed there, became of lesser importance, far overshadowed by the deeper undercurrents of what I was engaged in and the feelings that I felt while being there. A similar shift has happened to me in the past dozen or so years of weekly church attendance. Sure, I'm still very interested in what is being said and done there, and that it employs our best big picture gospel understandings. And I still want to perform my various parts well. Heck, if my fellow ward members even want to think of me as a smarty, who am I to want to dissuade them of that opinion? But somehow, even amidst the occasional, okay, not so occasional, bad theology, alienating rhetoric, and actions that are part of regular church attendance and active church watching, my persistent feeling is one of affection for this strange, quirky, and wildly imperfect family. What the church itself and the members immediate around me do that drive me crazy is overshadowed by feelings of love because they have shown me who they are. Even those who have the gift for pushing my buttons the most easily are like me, wanting to do good things for themselves, for their family, their community, and the wider world. And though our pace is maddening at times in our bumbling ways, I sense that we're all moving in the right direction, even if sometimes our needed course corrections have to come through backward steps. We've talked about some of those. The time in my week when I most often take the chance to examine these feelings about the church and my decision to stay actively engaged is during the sacrament service. In this past year or so, my meditations during this time have been enlivened by a couple of notions that I'd like to briefly pay tribute to here. The first came from the wonderful piece by Kathleen Flake in the July 1993 Sunstone, in which she expounds on extra elements that Latter-day Saint scripture and theology bring to sacrament worship, including the notion of the sacrament being a communal meal, a celebration of the hour in which Christ was with his disciples, and also an anticipation of future experiences of communion with him and with each other. Bill Hansen, here on this panel with me, has also contributed a beautiful element to my sacrament meeting meditations through remarks he made in a 2006 Sunstone panel on films that had expanded presenters' spiritual lives. In that session, he reflected on two films, Babette's Feast and Pieces of April, and he put them both in the context of there being stories in which rifts are healed through the act of sharing a meal. And Bill noted how there is nowhere else in which the spiritual meets the temporal in quite the same way as it does at the table. In this session, he also talked about the importance in the ancient world of the commensality, or the commensal relationship, the key role that food plays in establishing and deepening relationships. My recent recalling of this symposium session and Bill's insights has drawn me this year to rewatch and be deeply nourished by two films that directly portray the sacrament as a ritual meal aimed at reconciliation. The first, Places in the Heart, the Depression-era film in which Sally Field portrays a widow struggling to keep her land and succeeding through the aid of an unlikely collection of assistants, ends with a scene in church in which the bread and wine are passed from congregant to congregant, including some people not really present at the meeting, such as her deceased husband and the young black boy who had killed him, who was then lynched by town members. And it shows the various characters reconciling with each other as they softly declare peace of God before drinking the wine and passing it to the person next to them. The other is the powerful closing scene in Richard Dutcher's film Brigham City, which an entire LDS congregation refuses to partake of the sacrament until their bishop, who had chosen not to partake because he felt out of fellowship from them due to guilt over his not being able to stop the tragic events that happened in the film. They refused to take it until he came to accept their act of solidarity with him and then eat. Each week as the sacrament service takes place in my ward, rather than reading scripture or pondering some solemn thing about Christ's ordeal in the garden or on the cross, lately I find myself looking around at my fellow Overlake First Ward saints, most of them people whom, before I got to know them a bit, I otherwise wouldn't very likely hang with, and feeling very privileged to share this sacred meal with them, and feeling any and all rifts melt away. In her article, Flake suggests that the way Christ asked to be remembered by all of us who would be his disciples is through sharing a meal and sharing a life with each other. I stay because this is a call I want to answer. As I reflected on Toby's invitation to be on this panel, I knew right from the start that I would share something along the lines of what you just heard. But as I pondered a bit longer, it occurred to me that even if I weren't happy in my day-to-day church relationships, the only real reason I'd probably choose not to stay, rather than just fade into inactivity, was because I'd found somewhere better to go. Some other tradition that contained more truth, that was much closer fit for my spiritual and intellectual temperament. In other words, it's only my awareness of other traditions that would ever cause me to go. And some years ago, this indeed was an issue for me. As a student of other faiths and taught traditions, in several cases I dove so deeply into the beauties and insights of these faiths that I was quite tempted to jump. And indeed I did jump, at least within my heart. And what I mean by that is the only thing I would read was Taoism or, you know, just these books from these other traditions that would move me. I didn't read a Mormon book sometimes for years. I was then, and I still am, suffering from what Kirster Stendahl calls holy envy. The feeling that there is something in this other religious tradition that I really value and wish my tradition had, or at least developed and emphasized more thoroughly. At times, this envy even takes on the added depth of feeling to become what Stanford religion scholar Lee Yearley calls the emotion of spiritual regret. The profound realization, coupled with the feeling of sadness, that it's impossible to be more than one person at one time, and yet still wishing that we could be. It's the mixed experience of joy and regret at being given the life that we've been given, while also knowing that even though there are so many wonderful ways of human flourishing out there, neither we nor any one person can exhibit them all, inhabit them. I've been helped to transform this feeling of spiritual regret into something less painful, and now even to the point where I find it an exhilarating proposition through my work with Randy Paul and the Foundation for Interreligious Diplomacy. One of the questions, and this certainly isn't the main question of our foundation and what we're working on, but one of the natural questions that naturally comes up for theists who ponder the existence of or flourishing of other religious traditions, especially non-theistic ones, is why God would design the world this way, and if not design it, at least allow it and seemingly even encourage the diversity through giving people such strong spiritual confirmations about the truth and importance of their own traditions, understandings, and practices. If God is love, in what way is it loving to individuals or to the world to run things or allow things to run in this way? Wouldn't it be more loving to tell everyone once and for all what is what? God is certainly powerful enough to do that. In our musings together on this subject, Randy and I have come up with a speculative position on this question that I'm pretty excited about. I'll share only a small portion of what we're working on in approaching this question, but it begins in the descriptive fact that I kind of mentioned a bit here, that no human being, given the humans of humanists, can possibly grasp every truth. each moment we choose to pay attention to this or to that, it's impossible for any human to focus in a concentrated way on multiple things. Hence, we might consider it an act of a loving God to only ask us to truly learn and inhabit a small portion of the wondrous truths that make up all of reality. But there's another angle on this issue, and that is to ask how it might also be important and honoring to the different truths themselves for God to encourage the full flourishing of many, many faiths. In taking our thought in this direction, I was nudged by a statement by Krista Tippett in her book, Speaking of Faith. In conversing with hundreds of amazing religious folk, she says, "I began to imagine religious truth as something splintered and far-flung for good reason, as it was too vast for one tradition to encompass it. I saw Christian reformers across time as people who noticed a scattered piece of the Christian truth that the church itself was neglecting. They picked it up and loved its beauty, saw it as necessary, and embodied its virtues. The Anglicans saw common prayer. Lutherans saw the Bible. Mennonites saw pacifism. Calvinists saw intellectual rigor. And the Quakers saw silence. And the multitudinous traditions I haven't named in that inadequate summary see nuances of those pieces of truth and other aspects altogether, all of which make the whole more vivid, more possible in the world." She continues, "The analogy holds now as I go deeper into exploring the splinters of all the world's traditions. The gentle single-mindedness of Zen complements the searching discipline of Theravada Buddhism. The exuberant spirituality of Sufism rises to meet the daily lived piety of Sunni and Shiite Islam." And she goes on. From this entry point into the idea of that religious founders saw some piece of truth being neglected and therefore picked it up, loved its beauty, and saw it as essential, and embodied its virtues, I want to take this motivation even deeper and suggest that it even is possible that it is God's will. God wouldn't want... God would not want any truth to be neglected. But not only would God not want it to be neglected, God would want it to be as loved as possible, as deeply explored as humanly possible, as proclaimed and defended and put into ongoing human conversation as possible. To get to these points, these truths would have to be lived, explored deeply from the inside, as well as explored in comparison with others, so that aspects that can't be spotted by insiders will be brought out through the comparative encounter, so that the strengths it possesses will be made even more brawny through the individual and communal wrestle, both internally and in contestation with others. In these and the other ways, it makes a great deal of sense to me that it is absolutely God's will that there are many, many religions, and that there are great diversities of individuals and temperaments within each tradition, and that God would even send the Holy Spirit to testify and intensify our individual commitments to the truths that we hold and love and explore. It's truly an act of God. It's truly an act of love that God doesn't have us be all the religions at once, as we'd fail at that. And it is an act of love by God to the truths themselves, and hence to the world, to allow and even encourage deep, soulful commitment to the very particular truths. I've been exhilarated thinking along these lines. Perhaps it's true, perhaps not. But whatever the case may be, it has helped me become excited to stay and truly to make my contribution to the world by fully inhabiting and championing those pieces of neglected truth that Joseph Smith picked up on, and that God perhaps has now assigned to Mormonism to develop and make as robust as possible. In this quest, I'm encouraged by the wonderful call made by B.H. Roberts a century ago, which also served as an early inspiration for Scott Kenny as he founded Sunstone. Elder Roberts stated that the crying need of Mormonism is for thoughtful disciples who will not be content with merely repeating some of its truths, but will develop its truths and enlarge it by that development. The work of the expounder has scarcely begun. The prophet planted the germ truths of the great dispensation of the fullness of times. The watering and weeding is going on, and God is giving the increase and will give it more abundantly in the future as more intelligent discipleship shall attain. The disciples of Mormonism, growing discontented with the necessarily primitive methods which has hitherto prevailed in sustaining the doctrines, will yet take profounder and broader views of the great doctrines committed to the church, and departing from mere reputation will cast them in new formulas, cooperating in the works of the Spirit until they have until they help to give the truths received a more forceful expression and to carry it beyond the earlier and cruder stages of its development. Yes, I'm happy in the church, but why do I stay? Because I have a job to do, and I'm excited about doing it.
Excuse me if I talk from here. I'm small enough that you may not be able to see me, but I hope you can hear me. I'm waiting hip surgery after a spill on the tennis court. So anyhow, here we go. I appreciated listening to the wonderful ruminations of these young people. I'm a generation ahead of all of them. So this I want to talk about why I stay in the church. Seek not to counsel life, but to take counsel from its hand. Why do I stay in the church? Good grief, why would I ever leave it? It's my heritage, my belonging, my home. Oh, the counseling of life. Looking back to glean ideas for today's panel has been like entering a spider web. Nothing is less linear than memory, more complicated in its emergence. In that silvery configuration of remembering, I have gratefully come to know much more about why I am a Mormon. I love it. Any problems I have with the church are with organizational matters, not with believing. Three A's define my staying: allegiance, affinity, and affection. First, allegiance. It's my heritage. As far back as my great-grandfather Willard Richards, a way to follow. After offering to give his life in the place of his friend Joseph Smith, he then saw his prophet murdered in Carthage jail. Imagine the heartache. But he took word back to his sorrowing, angry people in Nauvoo and said what he claimed Joseph would have declared: peace instead of revenge, the opposite of negativity. He also went on to be the first editor of the Deseret News as well as a doctor healer. That conviction of peace, not war, came in my genes. I also love the idea of a visionary background in the church that the church was founded on, believing that God still is available not only to prophets who can change precepts. Okay, hold on, okay, is that better? Okay. I love the idea of a visionary background that the church was founded on, believing that God is still available not only to prophets who can change precepts, like polygamy and priesthood to the blacks, one expedient, but anyone willing to ask and to listen to the promptings of the Spirit. What with allegiance to that kind of pioneer steadfastness and optimism, and then I grew up imbibing peace in a home of joy and expectation of good. Ours was not a religion of rules and edicts superimposed upon life, but life itself, life from an eternal standpoint, life from God's point of view. Belonging meant reverence for life in a great variety, reverence for the kitchen as well as the canyon, for a family picnic and Bible stories read by mother and father, for throwing a ball or playing with dolls, both sides of my hybrid self, thriving with three brothers and with friends. Excuse me. Even during the Great Depression in the 30s, in so many ways like today, my father lost his car business, had to travel as a Lincoln Division manager, but he and mother wrote every day and let their unique outlook, start becoming. We never knew we were poor and relished the penny to spend at the confectionery like millionaires. Always accenting the positive father's motto was from athletics and initiating the church-wide MN basketball program. Try hard, play fair, and have fun. He made it all look appealing, not only on the court but in life. Our aesthetic poet and painter mother's motto was, pray at night, plan in the morning. Her faith was as embedded in our growing up healthy as her oatmeal for breakfast. Not scriptorian or obligatory, prayers, fasting, and blessings were natural and guaranteed healing like dew from heaven. Only one of my three brothers, Warner Brothers, Gill, went on a mission. Nor did Mel, but all of them were married in the temple and later became bishops. As attuned as we were to our heritage, we never felt our church had a corner on happy families or goodness. We grew up finding both all around us. Then there was affinity, the ineffable being drawn to. what can't be willed or willed away. Affinity began for me in high-ceilinged English Tudor Highland Park ward, also my home for 25 years before I was married. Here, religion was basic, too. I'm in perfect view. Two framed ovals set the pattern of my believing. High in the back of the chapel, the glory of God is intelligence, and in the most occupied anteroom, man is that he might have joy. What more sturdy invitations to a life of rich questing? As I hear more complicated formulas for faith recited near and far, and warnings about the drear world and the adversary, the old-fashioned in me still remembers the Beehive Creed I learned at 12. Have faith, seek knowledge, honor womanhood, know the sweetness of service, love one another. Simple and lasting as the words do I know that my Redeemer lives are for the strength of the hills, sung with great fervor. Or the articles of faith, memorized and internalized like the word of wisdom, especially the first incorporated not as we believe, but as I believe, in God the Eternal Father, and in His Son Jesus Christ, and in the Holy Ghost, and on to the 13th, to endure and hope and to seek after anything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. Also sitting for all those years in Highland Park ward, engendered in me an affinity for Joseph Smith, as real as the Lee Green Richards painting in the sacred grove, of the sacred grove in the nave of its high chapel. 60 years later, in a poetry workshop in New Smyrna Beach, Florida, I would write an assigned poem to explain to my multi-faith new friends excerpts here, excerpts from the poem. Suppose he really saw the vision, God, the angel. My church owns the story. Joseph in the grove, 14. A supernatural sight of extraordinary beauty and significance. The boy kneeling at the elevated feet of the Father and the Son while praying for a truth that had eluded others. A supernatural sight of extraordinary beauty and significance. And later, after a life-altering accident on the freeway and a death experience, a realization. Not till today this small comet in my scalp. This clattering of memory, the painting in the chapel of my childhood against the organ loft, Joseph kneeling at the elevated feet of the Father and the Son. Did the artist put it in, the vision, or did I? The sacred grove, sun streaming on the boy at prayer, indelible unknowing like the features of a mother giving milk, in the chapel of my childhood against the organ loft, the vision. The following year, I was in that ward for a missionary farewell where I'd not been for maybe 30 years. I spent the whole meeting enthralled with the painting. No boy at prayer, no father, no son, only the garden. But the vision is real to me as my place at the dinner table with mother and father and my brothers. Along the years, I've had questions about trying to institutionalize faith, about this organizational behavior or that that seemed like sanctioning of ill will, disciplining thinkers and discouraging the likes of Sunstone or Dialogue. But this has always been my church and in it my people of like and unlike persuasions. Even as I might struggle and seek both sides of a question, I would be cosmically orphaned without it. Individual and believing, responding by affinity differently to different leaders, I'm thankful for various kinds of goodness to respond to. Last time I was on a panel like this was in 1985. The pillars of my faith. While still believing as well as questing since, I found that life both inside and outside church experience has expanded the sense of direction I knew at that time. The second chapter in my latest book, The Place of Knowing, a Spiritual Autobiography, it's been out in audio with Amazon, will be out in print in December, tells where that spiritual journey has taken me. Out of a death experience a year after that Sunstone panel, I say in the second chapter that the pillars of my faith are still intact, but the roof has blown blessedly off the structure to reveal a whole sky full of stars. Let me explain. Those 24 years ago, I was the wife of Mel Thane, mother of 5 daughters, 2 grandchildren, recently part of the YWMI General Board, an only woman for 17 years on the Deseret News Board of Directors. My church orientation then was downtown, in the heart of the church. An intimate acquaintance with the running of it by the man around that big table in the church office building at 4087 East South Temple. I had weekly engagement with co-chairman Tom Monson and Jim Faust, discussed issues with Bishop Victor Brown, Apostles Neil Maxwell, Dallin Oaks, and Jeff Holland, as well as others I respected as part of the paper, Wendell Adams, Bill Smart, and Glenn Snar. Banker Bob Bishop was the token non-Mormon, and I was the token woman, but we were never treated as such. Despite frustrations and losing more battles than I won, we were friends about the business of seeing the Deseret News through an era of competitive and challenging readership into an age of computers and the internet that would overwhelm the print industry. Those compatriots in solving business matters have stayed friends and part of my loyalty, as well as my connectedness to the church. I can still go to them with my questions. Such has been my association in the heart of the church. From those men and the women on the General Dwight W. MIA board, led by inimitable Florence Jacobson and inspired by gutsy, talented, diverse, and forever friends on the Miami, Laurel, and Writing Committees, concerned with worldwide teaching of lessons and offering of programs. It was for one of those programs at June conference that I wrote in an hour of great need words for what was to become my testimony. Where can I turn for peace? He answers privately, answers my reaching. I called my friend Jolene Meredith. She sat at her piano, and as I read a line, she composed a line. In an hour, we had our closing song. At the time, our oldest of five daughters suffered from a terrifying bout of manic depression and bulimia. Jolene was battling a familial depression herself. In 1970, the church had not addressed the possibility of either. Years later, the Church News invited me to write about the hymn in connection with the search for peace, privately and globally. The hymn would never have happened without our companionship on that Laurel Committee. This leads me to affection. The eight of us have been eating and laughing together ever since that Laurel Committee. Pure serendipity, the affection of those years so different from each other. Four married, four single. They brought more diversity than conformity to our so congenial efforts. Much like my reading and writing for Sunstone Dialogue Exponent 2, along with the improvement era, the Children's Friend, the Ensign, and the Church News, I've grown richer through the enlightening balance I've found in them. Those who were also years of heading a dedicated writing committee of gifted men and women to prepare lessons rooting girls not only in the gospel, but in real life. We booby-trapped the lesson with questions so it couldn't be just read aloud, and always urged the teacher to adapt to suit her class. I also taught lessons in Relief Society literature out of the best books, and was intriguingly taught by resourceful others about social relations, cultural refinement, as well as theology. So how can I help but be sad as those lessons have all become theology, written by men, about men, leaders, with quotes only by men and intended for women. Admonitions not to add or subtract from what's in the manual. Still the affection for everyone concerned. In 1985, for me, the church was mostly downtown. Now, the church, as we've heard from these others, is our ward on the street, where we've lived for 54 years. Talk about affection. About two decades ago, our entire bishopric set me apart as a ward greeter. I was often late and always chatting on my way to my comfort zone. How better to harness my wanting to stay in touch, literally and figuratively, than in hugs and handshakes with belongers as dear as my Laurel Committee or friends on the board? Last Tuesday, 40 of those dear Relief Society sisters from our ward gathered at our cabin as we had for years. Old, young, and in between, different from each other as the color of their hair, in a natural setting different from us sitting in a classroom. Each told a line from a favorite song, and we sang it with two guitars, as filled with affection for each other and the gospel that brings us together as through the thorough forest and blue sky. God's world put arms around us. I get to give talks near and far and find the same willingness to care for and about members and non-members. On Tuesdays, I'm visiting in the Temple View Room of the Salt Lake Temple, with those sometimes waiting impatiently for a marriage or sealing, some just touring. My calling is to make them feel not marginalized, to get acquainted with their places and pensions. I've met fascinating people. About Mormonism, I wish I could introduce them to my spiritual home right up our street, still full of surprise and learning, living life and believing. Once a Jewish poet friend asked me why I stay Mormon. I wrote about Helen Keller and the Tabernacle in the 1930s, her outstretched hand in the back of the organ. I'm sorry. As Alexander Schreiner played Company of Saints, Helen Keller cried. The little girl felt it, the seeing without seeing, the hearing without hearing, the going by feel towards something holy, something that could touch the heart of a little girl like the sway of wind and willows. It happens all the time, that believing, through life as well as the Mormonism I love. And so I live with a kind of naivete of the spirit and with allegiance, affinity, and affection, holding me gently above water. I receive forgiveness for frailties and impunity for living outside the memo world. I voice my contrary opinions have been mellowed by those contrary to mine. I've found that lost causes can be forgettable as illnesses or surgeries, not to be ignored, but dealt with expecting healing. As Helen Keller says about her country, I say about my church. If I did not love it so much, I would not wish to mend her flaws as well as accept her strengths. Mostly it's just plain loving what's there, like a grandson in an ill-fitting suit in a pulpit, telling of finding his way to believing enough to head for Paraguay for 2 years, and like a list of 54 from his high school, headed for New Zealand, Albania, or Tooele to absorb a culture. Regardless of their eventualities, off to a spiritual maturing particular, to a peculiar chance to grow. It's his cousin just months before telling in touching directness how he came from skateboarding. He's right out there. Going to North Carolina, excuse me.
We're on this.
Yeah. Coming to love people in the Bible Belt, so unlike him, and tears giving his testimony. It's a young father giving a name and a blessing to his baby girl to find herself and caring about others. It's a special primary boy reciting a poem I'd written for him for Mother's Day, remembering every word and grinning as he finishes. It's a Down syndrome 18-year-old bearing her testimony in the pulpit to a smiling congregation. It's a string ensemble at Easter with a Jewish violinist joining in. It's a bishop giving me a blessing to get past a too long illness, invoking Father and Mother in Heaven. It's forever nurse friend with blessing in her daily back rubs after surgery. It's a leader sanctioning a new idea without a memo or a precedent. It's hearing a talk at a Mormon funeral with three objectives in mind: to honor the dead, to comfort the living, and to contemplate the eternal, and to say it's okay to grieve as well as to believe. It's the plan in action. It's joining my uncertain voice in my dear congregation saying, oh, how lovely was the morning, as others harmonize around me. It's tearing up as our five daughters play I Love at Home in sacrament meeting. Their violins, flute, piano as congenial as our times hiking or water skiing. It's my husband sealing our midlife daughter and our new husband in the Manti Temple after an agonizing divorce, surrounded by loving family and friends both inside and outside. It's fasting and a common faith for whatever the will of the Lord for the desperately ill neighbor and expecting peace. It's a young elder in Hong Kong after translating sacrament meeting in Mandarin, telling me he loves our hymn. If I weren't a missionary, I'd like a hug. Me replying, I'm not, and I can be your mother. Some hug. It's help around the block and around the world offered in emergency aid to Mormons and non-Mormons alike. I have no idea how this computer or my cell phone work. I only know that they do. In the same way, I know that God operates within law and influences my doings just as surely and at my choosing to connect. Do I write as a woman, as a mother, as a wife, as a Mormon? All are as inseparable as smoke and flame. I have simply to live and write by what I love. Through allegiance, affinity, and affection, the pillars of my faith are still intact, and yes, the roof has blown blessedly off the structure to reveal a whole sky full of stars. I wonder what the next how many years of the counseling of life might have to say about why I stay both here and then there. Anything but negative, that wondering, I can hardly wait to see. By a saying by Prophet Gordon B. Hinckley mounted on the mantle beside where I ride my recumbent bike, so like those in my Highland Park ward 80 years ago, life is to be enjoyed, not just endured. Yes, yes, yes.
I want to thank our participants today for sharing those very personal moments, and I think inspirational.